This is the Freeman Report on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello and welcome to the second hour of today's Freeman Report. It is Thursday, the 2nd of May, 2024. I'm your host, James Freeman. And if you've just joined me, I've been discussing the WHO Pandemic Accord Treaty and the proposed amendments to the International Health Regulations and the upcoming vote later this month at the World Health Assembly. My guest for that discussion was public health expert Dr. David Bell. So this is the second expert I've had on this week. So James Roguski was on the Freeman Report on Monday. And it's been quite a revolution for me this week because I've, like many around the world, have been jumping up and down about, you know, the proposals to give the WHO legal powers and all the wording on the text and everything. And actually now I've realised, as James and David confirmed today, actually a lot of that is meaningless because, you know, the countries mandated stuff. They broke their own laws and international law anyway. What this treaty is really about and the threat that it poses is that it is basically an international trade agreement. It is a way of sharing out the spoils from future pandemics, making them more profitable for the big corporations. And as like wars, if they're profitable, then what you end up with is more wars, or in this case, more pandemics. So that is the threat, the actual treaty itself, because it is an international trade agreement, essentially. I also spoke with one of the candidates for the imminent election of the next leader for the UK Independence Party, Bill Etheridge. We talked about immigration. We talked about what the hopes and desires are of UKIP voters. And as I said at the end of the show, the vote or count, I think your votes closes on Monday. So if you haven't voted yet and you are a UKIP member, get that vote in now. Otherwise, you will miss out. And if you missed that first hour and fancy watching back, I would definitely recommend the first segment with Dr. David Bell. If you're interested in the WHO, then it will be uploaded to the website in the next few hours. So just head over to the website at www.tntradio.live, or you can go via the app. And in both cases, if you click on the episodes button, then you'll be able to watch or listen back to all of my previous shows. Right, so coming up in this hour, I'll once again be talking about the violence on the streets of our big cities, and separately, the immigration problem we're seeing across Western nations. My guest for this discussion will be private investigator and Sunday Times best-selling author Christine Hart. She has been on the Freeman Report before, and I'm delighted that she's going to be with us in just a second. Then in the final segment of today's show, I'll be talking about Israel and the Middle East with author and geopolitical analyst Mats Nilsson. I'm interested to hear what Mats' views are on the difference between Judaism and Zionism, because the two, I think, are very often conflated, particularly by those who want to defend Israel's actions. We've heard from the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, in the past few days, who has claimed that the International Criminal Court, the ICC, is being anti-Semitic just by the mere fact that it is considering whether to issue arrest warrants for Israeli leaders, maybe even himself. Netanyahu also says protests around the world are anti-Semitic, which is a load of horseshit, as far as I'm concerned, because people are not, or most people are not, against Judaism. They're not against Jews. In fact, on the London protests, you've got thousands of Jews that are actually standing side by side those calling for a ceasefire. No, they are against the Zionist agenda being driven by the Israeli government. You know, and I think there's many of us have been clear for a long time now that Israel is conflating the two on purpose so that it can use, you know, and play the victim and say, you know, they're being anti-Semitic, whatever the criticism is, even though it's actually against policy actions by the Israeli government. So I'll be here really interested to hear Matt's view on all of that. But before we go over to our news correspondent, Gemma Cooper, for today's breaking news, I would like to talk a little bit about wood burners. Now, many of you will know that I've got one fitted back in November, because I didn't stop talking about it at the time for weeks on end after having it fitted. And ever since then, I've been reading, government documents and plans, particularly by the devolved governments in the UK, plans to stop restricting their use. Now, I get it that it's not really a great idea if too many houses in our crowded cities start burning wood and other fuels via stoves because of the particles they put in the air. Although I must say that modern burners are extremely efficient if you burn kiln-dried wood, which I do. Anyway, the other excuse governments are using to restrict burners is climate change. The Scottish Government, for example, has just brought in a new law banning wood burners from being installed into new houses, even in rural locations where houses are not connected to the gas mains. So, I was delighted to come across a report that was actually produced by the Scottish Government itself, that actually shows that wood-burning stoves produce less CO2, if you believe all that nonsense, versus other forms of heating. Yes, that's right. The report found that CO2 emissions from wood fuels are not only lower compared with fossil fuel burners like gas boilers, but are also lower than heating from so-called renewable technologies such as ground source heat pumps, heat generated using solar panel and wind turbines. Provided the wood burnt in those burners is sourced locally and is dry wood. That's really, really important. The stats are the following. Wood fuels produce 25 grams to 97 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour versus 48 grams for wind, 105 grams to 190 for solar, 123 grams for ground source heat pumps, 211 for gas, 304 for oil, 433 for electricity, and 1,102 for coal. And like I said, this is based upon a report that the Scottish Government itself produced. Apparently, according to rumours, they expected wood burners to be worse than so-called green technologies, although the truth in any regards hasn't changed policy in Scotland. Absolutely ridiculous. Anyway, this is something that I was a report that I came across in the past couple of days, and it is something that I'm going to be talking about in more detail next week. We're going to try and find an expert that will come on and discuss that. If you want to get in touch to suggest a topic that's close to your heart, email me at jamesfreeman@tntradio.live. And if you want to join in the conversation, get yourself over to tntradio.live and click on the chat icon. My name is James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report for today's News Talk TNT.
Getting straight to the facts.
Enough with the lies. We need facts.
This is today's News Talk Radio TNT.
Right, over to our UK news correspondent, Gemma Cooper, for today's breaking news.
Thank you very much, James. Well, a few headlines have changed since we last spoke at the top of the last hour. Humza Yousaf, the outgoing First Minister of the Scottish National Party and leader of Scotland at the moment, has undertaken what could be his last First Minister's Questions at Holyrood in Edinburgh. He took a bit of a ribbing from the Scottish Conservatives, who allegedly brandished a letter saying that last week he was begging for their support and they didn't give their support in the vote of no confidence yesterday. A bit of political to and fro and argy-bargy in the Scottish Parliament there, and a bit of joshing as Humza Yousaf is obviously on his way out. And the former leader of the party, John Swinney, has officially put his hat in the ring today to be the next leader of the SNP. And surprisingly, Kate Forbes, who stood against Humza Yousaf as leader when Nicola Sturgeon stepped down a few years ago, resigned rather a few years ago. She said she's not going to put a hat in the ring for this race. John Swinney, so far, the only official candidate to replace Humza Yousaf as the leader of the SNP. Also, the polls have opened across England and Wales. They've been open for several hours now for the local mayoral and police and crime commissioner elections across England and Wales. But the weather is shocking here in the UK, James, as I'm sure you know. You live in South Wales, which is an area battered by storms overnight. It remains to be seen how much political apathy and the weather have stopped people going to the polls today. The polling stations don't close until 10 p.m. tonight in the UK, so we'll know tomorrow morning and tomorrow afternoon what the results are. But I wonder what the electoral landscape looks like, shifting sands after the events post-2020. People have lost faith in the political process. And also, it's a very disturbing story, but it's worth mentioning. There's an extraordinary sentencing hearing at the Old Bailey in London, which is ongoing as we speak. An extreme body modification website is under examination. The ringleader, Marius Gustafsson, who operated from a flat and hotels and other locations in North London, rented apartments, operated a body modification website, which garnered more than 22,000 users from across the world, all paying to see things like enforced castrations, amputations, all carried out by people that had no medical qualifications whatsoever. And victims who consented were promised money from procedures of this crime, weren't given them. Three people have already been sentenced in this case. It's a huge case. Two people have already pleaded guilty and five are awaiting sentence, Marius Gustafsson, the ringleader, amongst them. It's a very distressing case. It's in the Old Bailey at the moment, but I think kind of microcosm of an indication of where we are in society, James. A very disturbing case indeed.
I'm intrigued. My gruesome curiosity is intrigued. What kind of procedures, Gemma?
Well, castration, amputation, limbs frozen and then sawn off. I mean, it's very gruesome. It is a very, very a gruesome case. Some people have already been sentenced. Gustafsson, who's the ringleader, was described as an arch manipulator in court today. The procedures were carried out at his home in North London, rented apartments in North London or hotels around the London and Greater London area. And the victims, one was a 16-year-old boy. You know, they consented to the procedures. They were promised money from the procedures, but they didn't get any. And this is a website that operated by subscription between 2017 and 2021. Some subscriptions are as little as £100 a month. But in total, Mr. Gustafsson, the ringleader, made £300,000 privately in payments from this website. 22,800 registered users from across the world. Some of the procedures. I don't want to. For me, it's a bit. I'll give you the website itself was called Eunuch Maker. That's what the website was called. So we're talking castration, penis removal in some cases. Mr. Gustafsson's own penis was amputated. He's now in a wheelchair. His penis was found in a drawer in his home almost 4 years after it was amputated. He's had his leg frozen, the tip of his nipple removed. And also he's seen on this website tasting a severed penis. I mean, I know this sounds ridiculous, but this is what's come out at the Old Bailey today. All of the victims, as I say, consented, but these are just guilty. It's a sentencing hearing. It's not a trial. But this is where we are in our society. This seems
Gemma,
like could be the what.
I was going to talk about Humza Yousaf, but I don't know whether I've got...
How we get from What's one wrong? To the other.
Yeah. What is wrong with people? Honestly, all of the people involved. I mean, obviously, there's this case against the ringleader, the person who orchestrated all this. But, you know, if he's made £300,000 from subscriptions, what is wrong with the people who are paying to watch this? Absolutely astonishing, Gemma. Absolutely astonishing. It's more like a script from a horror movie, to be honest with you.
Absolutely. I thought that myself as this headline came across my news radar just in the last hour since you and I last spoke on the Freeman Report. I mean, just some of the things, you know, that the perpetrator's own penis was amputated and all kinds of things. But there were more than 22,000 people across the globe paying to watch this kind of surgical, well, they're not surgical procedures. They were carried out by people with no medical qualifications whatsoever. So for the victims, God knows what they went through. They consented thinking they were going to get money. I mean, it's awful. It's an awful crime. But I thought we should talk about this on TNT.
Absolutely.
It's at the Old Bailey in London. It's ongoing. It's a sentencing. And does this show where we are? Some of us in society will pay to watch this. I mean, I can't get my head around it, nor can you. Probably if you're listening, you can't either, but it's happening.
Things like this, I mean, they kind of scare me really, because you kind of, it's evidence that there's some really sick, twisted, mentally unhinged, I don't know what other words to use, people in the world. There really are. Hopefully, there's not very many of them. But yeah, wow. Okay. All right. I'm going to move on, Gemma, because I just want to shake that off, I think, the thoughts about that.
Sorry, James.
Right, okay. Thank you, Gemma. Obviously, you'll be back tomorrow on tomorrow's Freeman Report to finish off the week. It's Friday already. Right, to the rest of you, don't go anywhere though, because I've got a great second hour of the show. I've got Christine Hart next, private investigator and Sunday Times best-selling author. And then after Christine, I've got Mats Nilsson, author and geopolitical expert. So a great show lined up. Don't go anywhere. Stay right where you are, right here on TNT.
TNT's David Curtin.
Rishi Sunak has been threatening that he will do this and saying, oh, we'll do this, we'll come out of the ECHR, that is, not anything else. But he hasn't done so. And then he's saying, well, if we're elected in the general election this year, which is highly unlikely, then we may come out and we may give notice to come out if we're re-elected in 2024-2025. By that time, another year or 2 years will have passed, and another 100,000 or so military-aged men will have crossed the channel in small boats with not a single flight taking off to take some bogus asylum seekers to Rwanda.
David Curtin on today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. On air 24/7. This is today's News Talk TNT.
Okay. Absolutely delighted to welcome back Christine Hart. She has been on the Freeman Report before. She's a private investigator and a Sunday Times best-selling author. Welcome back to the show, Christine.
Thank you. Hi, James. Lovely to be with you today. How are you?
It is. Yeah. It's not a very nice day today. There's been raining.
I know.
It hasn't stopped raining this year, has it?
No, it hasn't. No, absolutely not. So, yeah, thunderstorms and lightning last night. It's really, the gods aren't pleased with us, I would say.
Yeah, well, they're not pleased with some people anyway, I think, on this planet at the moment. Yeah. But anyway, I didn't get you to talk. I didn't on the show to talk about the weather, Christine. I guess first up, I'd like to hear your response and your sort of assessment on this attack yesterday in Hainault with the guy with the sword. What are your thoughts on all of this and the wider question, I guess, about knife crime and violence in the UK?
Yes. Well, I think they need more police on the streets. I think it would be better if the police were armed because, you know, I believe there was a female cop who had to reach out and literally disarm this man who is going crazy with a long knife. So with knife crime, you have to tackle it with a better weapon. So I think armed police, you know, why not? Because they have it in America. And I think England is just following suit with America. I mean, that man walking around with a knife, he could have, you know, literally been taken out a lot earlier. We had, you know, more cops walking the street and more cops armed. I think that is, I feel sorry for the police. I mean, you know, they're just ordinary working class men and women, and they have to go out and risk their lives. You know, it's not good, is it? It's not fair.
Yeah, it is. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's absolutely, I'm sure you've seen the video as well, Christine, of when they actually tasered him. And got to give credit to that lady, particularly the one who tasered him second, because she just walked towards him and he's got, you know, a sword in his hand. So, well done, that lady.
She was amazing. I wouldn't have done that. No way. I mean, she was amazing. She did it to save lives. And, you know, her name should be out there. We should be thanking her all over.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think, though, about sentencing? I was talking about this on the show yesterday, because when you look at the sentencing for guns, for example, you have a minimum sentence of 5 years. But for knives, it's up to 4 years. And when you actually look at the sentences being served or given down, I think the average sentence is 7.5 months for knives, for holding a knife illegally.
It's crazy. I think they could up that, you know, by a lot and have more of this stop and search, and also make it a longer term for knives, like 10 years, that kind of thing. You don't need to go out carrying a knife, you know. If none of us were holding knives, then we'd all be safe. As some, you know, section of the community decide to do that, and so the rest of us aren't safe. I mean, that little boy that died because, you know, we haven't got stricter deterrence, like, you know, 10 years for carrying a knife. I mean, that was a sword, though, wasn't it? It was pretty horrific. I mean, that poor child, it's just can't carry on. There has to be something, you know, put in place to stop this. It's horrific, isn't it? It's like a horror story. We're supposed to be a civilized country, and yet we're not.
Yeah, and I mean, look, you know, in countries around the world, things like this happen from time to time. But it is the fact that this is, I forget the exact figures, but I mean, you know, the number of knife attacks a year now is absolutely ridiculous, and it's getting worse in the UK. So far, what politicians have talked about is just banning knives, certain types of knives. In fact, actually, it was ridiculous, that was, because they only banned the machete-type knives that had certain text on them. They didn't ban the actual knives themselves. It was only if it was like, I don't know what they call them, but if it was, you know, purposely kind of intended to be a symbol of violence and whatever, then they were banned. It's interesting that politicians go down that route, because it's not knives that kill people, it's people. Christine, why do you think the politicians in the UK, given this has been a problem for some time now, are not dealing with it and actually increasing the sentences?
I think it's because working class people take the brunt, you know, and the politicians we have, they're all quite elite, they're all quite well-to-do, and they don't see the problem of living on the street in normal areas. They're out in Surrey in the Greenbelt, and so it's not their problem. And if someone happens to be stabbed, if a child is murdered, again, they have such a huge distance from it. Like Rishi Sunak, for instance, you know, how much money has he got? 700 million. And it makes you feel as if you're, I would imagine, it makes you feel as if you're above other people. And so it's like, the problems of the peasants, so to speak. And this is why it's a lack of caring. They haven't got any heart. They haven't got any connection. They're disconnected. Therefore, they actually really don't care. And I know it's hard for people to believe that they don't care, but they literally don't care.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if, because, you know, I guess if you're going to increase sentences, and the problem is a big one at the moment, then I guess, you know, whilst that deterrent kind of works its way through the communities, you're going to have more people being sent to prison. I do wonder if actually it's because they don't want to highlight the fact that the prisons are full.
The prisons are full. The prisons are in a mess. Yes, we need to build more prisons. That sounds awful. But, you know, there's plenty of room. As I say, in the Surrey Greenbelt, there's loads of room to build prisons, you know, and maybe have them places where people are actually rehabilitated. Now, at the moment, they go into prisons and it's taken over by different groups and they just train to become better criminals. So a whole overhaul of the prison system where they were actually rehabilitated and taught to not be dysfunctional, taught to be functional and to enjoy that, you know, a lot more mental health in prisons. There's no mental health in prisons. People don't believe that, but there actually isn't. People assume they go into prison and they get mental health help. No, they don't. They get nothing. They get thrown in there. They get, you know, completely ignored. There was a voluntary service going into the Borstals. That's now stopped. So boys that go into Borstal, they don't get any counselling whatsoever. And of course, they need it desperately. They just have the older boys who just recruit
them.
It's
funny, isn't it? Because when I was growing up, Margaret Thatcher and other conservative leaders, law and order was, you know, that was their bag, wasn't it, the Conservatives? Mm. And they've just I know kind of policing in London is Rishi's responsible for that, but the Tories in government are responsible for the laws in the UK which the police, the Met Police, can then enforce. So again, it's just another, I think, example of how this Conservative Party are not conservative at all. Christine, we're going to take a break now for the news headlines. When we come back, I want to talk about this story about, I think she's called Lilian Sinoy Barr, who's set to become Northern Ireland's first black mayor. I'd like to hear your analysis and comments on that story. So don't go anywhere, Christine. Stay right where you are, right here on TNT.
Question. Huh? What are you guys doing today?
The news.
Now, TNT Radio News.
Sounds good.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. Former US President Donald Trump has announced an historic plan to protect the integrity of the upcoming presidential election. Johnson & Johnson has offered to cough up $6.5 billion to settle over 50,000 lawsuits claiming its talcum powder products cause ovarian cancer. And one of Australia's largest banks has announced its customers will no longer be able to deposit or withdraw cash.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk. TNT Radio. TNT Radio.
Yeah, Christine, it's an interesting story, this, because you think, given all the worries with immigration at the moment, that putting somebody up as a former refugee herself, that maybe she wouldn't have got enough votes. But I guess with these mayor elections, I don't know what the turnout was for this one, but the turnout is very, very often very, very low, isn't it? Like local elections, sometimes you only get 20%, 25% of the population, the voting population, coming out and voting. What's your thoughts more widely on this story, though?
I think, you know, she's obviously a very beautiful woman. She's an activist. She's got a lot to offer in that she has a massive passion. But I think she came in and started on the wrong foot. You know, the people from Derry, it's a very sort of cut off. I've been to Derry. I lived in Belfast for a long time. And when you travel into Derry from Belfast, it's like going into the ends of the world. It's incredibly cut off. So they're quite an insular group of people that are used to familiarity, you know, having everything familiar. So it would have been a shock to them. They would have been completely shocked. And then she started saying that anybody that was against mass migration was a terrorist. And I think that really upset the local people, because, of course, they had the Bloody Sunday. They had, you know, the British Army shooting at them, at innocent protesters. They've had the British calling them terrorists for a long, long time. So for someone to come in who, you know, they don't recognise as one of them, if I went there, I wouldn't be recognised as one of them. They're quite insular. If I chose to go and live in Derry, I would be talked about. This is the kind of area it is. It's not cosmopolitan. It's not London. And, you know, to do that, it's quite, you know, it's quite upsetting for the locals. And somebody said to me on Twitter that, you know, oh, she had a good right to call them terrorists. There's a lot of IRA here. There's a lot of INLA. I think it's a stronghold of INLA. But I remember doing a story for the Daily Mail, and the I heard through a contact that the INLA were paid $7 million to disband. So these guys that ran these terrorist groups, such as the INLA, which was very big in Derry, they're now off in Spain and Ibiza. And you have to think, you know, why did this go on? You know, and how much was Sinn Féin actually paid if INLA were paid $7 million? That's an awful lot of money for actually a group of people that were mostly, dare I say it, drug dealers and just, you know, people on the street causing trouble, kneecapping other people. So one has to look at that and say, you know, why did that take place? Why were those people paid all that money? You know, same with the UDA. The UDA, they took out their commanders. C Company went off to live in London. So now there's no UDA. So it's totally, you know, without any paramilitaries. So people that are complaining about paramilitaries, they've all been gone. The British paid them and now they're off living in other places or in big houses and settled down. So there aren't actually any terrorists left there. You know, they've all been paid off, so they're not there. So for her to come out and start saying, you know, the people of Derry, if they didn't appreciate mass immigration, is they should be called terrorists, is a little bit upsetting, I think, for the locals, and rightly so. You know, it's not right. She's not being sensitive as to the history of the people of Derry.
Yeah. And Christine, obviously, you've got you've done a lot of work in Northern Ireland on the situation there with the IRA and whatnot. What's your assessment of Ireland as a whole? Because, you know, we were told when we voted for Brexit by EU officials that our punishment, the UK's punishment, will be to lose Northern Ireland, and that there would be reunification. What are your thoughts on where we are? Do you think that is going to happen in the next half decade?
Well, I think for some reason, when Rishi has announced this Rwanda thing, that, you know, the people are now relocating in Ireland. So I think it is probably a plan to let go of Northern Ireland and let them reunify, because I don't think Britain ever wanted Northern Ireland. It was only because they didn't want the Protestants in the area to rise up and, you know, cause a civil war there in Northern Ireland. But they don't want it. I mean, there's no money there. It's not as if there's an oil field there or gold there. I mean, there is large unemployment there. There's not a lot of industry there. So it's something that they don't want. So I think letting go of it will be something that they want to do. And I guess emptying over a lot of migrants that England doesn't want by, you know, announcing this new Rwanda change, it can dump all the migrants that it doesn't want onto Ireland and then just push the boats out and, you know, get rid of a double problem. I mean, it's quite clever. I think the English have played the long game in this.
That's a really, really interesting way of looking at it. Of course, you're talking about the British establishment there and not those who voted for Brexit, because I think a lot of people in the UK are quite upset with what's happened with Northern Ireland. But interesting.
I think we the people are kept in the dark while those at the top plan, you know, plan the long game and plan what they want. And, you know, I feel for all of us at the moment. You know, it's a quick change. Change is happening. What's going out on Palestine is really shocking, the genocide of people that we're all watching on Twitter. And I think people are generally afraid of what those at the top are doing. What are they actually up to? It's quite terrifying. Yeah. What have you got planned for us next? I would say another COVID, another lockdown. Most of the migrants coming in are young men. They're being put up in huts and houses, and pubs are being reconverted, even though we've got homeless on the street. So why are all these men being brought in? I would say next time there's a lockdown, they'll be given jobs as private security, and it'll be, you know, you'll stay in your home and you'll do exactly what we say. It's actually quite frightening. I think there is something really dark headed our way.
There is. And you mentioned the Middle East there. So I'd like to get your view on Benjamin Netanyahu. Of course, it is quite a common thing we see where any criticism of Israel's actions is basically called anti-Semitic. All of the protesters are anti-Semitic, even the International Criminal Court, because it's considering obviously arrest warrants for leaders in Israel. Apparently they're anti-Semitic as well. Do you think that it's time, long overdue, that we called out Israel on this? Because it seems to be they're conflating Judaism and Zionism. And what people are actually criticizing is the policies of Israel, the Zionist policies. They're not necessarily against Jews. We've seen in London, there's thousands of Jews coming out on the protests calling for a ceasefire. What are your thoughts, Christine?
I think it's terrifying what they're doing. They don't seem to care about international law. I mean, I think they're playing that sort of master race card, and the rest of us are sitting back in terror thinking, you know, what's going to happen next? Who's next? And we've seen them literally wipe out, children. And I mean, the videos that have come out, I don't know if you've seen them, but children just crumbling, people holding up their children in Palestine and their bodies just crumbling and seeing, you know, I saw a little girl with her jaw cut open and they had to pull it back. You could see her teeth. I mean, the suffering and the white phosphorus has been terrifying. It almost seems as if the leaders over there, and of course they're the leaders of our country and the US, are actually non-human. Do you get that feeling, happening, you know? Is it some kind of, you know, you watch movies like Oblivion, there's that Netflix series Colony, you can't help but think, is that what's gone on? I know I'm going to sound mad, but you can't help but think, is that what's gone on? Because it's unprecedented what's going on right now in the world.
It is, isn't it? And you know, what the media tell us and what the politicians talk about is sides. I don't think they're, you know, I think a lot, there's a large number of people around the world now that don't give a monkey's about sides, about Israel. And this is about innocent people, women, children and men, just being slaughtered in the name of what we don't know. Because I've got my own ideas on why I think this conflict is taking place at the moment. But I think, you know, there's big questions of whether, whether actually Israel wanted this conflict so that it get its hand on all that gas off of Gaza and, the canal. Yeah.
It's always about money and power, you know. It's always about money and power, boils down to money and power, yes. And other things. If you look at the spiritual component as well, it's all very Ragnarok and the Midgard serpent and, you know, that kind of thing. If you look at Norse Myths, there's a good book by Neil Gaiman. It looks like it's all kicking off right now. We've got literally the twilight of the gods going on in the planet. And it's, you know, it's very interesting. It's an interesting time to be alive. It's certainly a terrifying time to be alive.
It is an interesting time to be alive. I just hope we can watch on our TVs as we are now and watch it on TNT rather than it actually coming to here if it's going to happen at all. Anyway, listen, we have run out of time. Christine, thank you so much for coming back on the Freeman Report. Do please come back again soon.
Oh, thank you very much, James. Thank you. Take good care.
Thank you, Christine Hart, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Right, we are going to take a short break now. And when we come back, I'm going to be speaking with author and geopolitical expert Matt Nilsson. I'll be asking him that same question about Netanyahu and the common sort of practice, if you can put it like that, of conflating what I think is Judaism and Zionism. And basically, any criticism of Israel is just being called anti-Semitic, which is a load of horseshit as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, I'll be really interested to hear what Matt's view is after this short break right here on TNT.
I was a quarterback at Hardaway High School. College first round draft pick, on and off the field. We were taught to not show any signs of weakness. During the football season, I would stop eating. But I didn't know I was depressed. I thought that something was wrong with me. For 20 plus years was physical, physical, physical. We didn't have any education behind what mental health was. I started to learn it starts here first. If this is together, I'll be better as a father, as a man, and as a husband. Put the importance on your mental health. I'm not scared to talk about it anymore. The first tool is therapy. The second one is positive self-talk. And then journaling, putting your thoughts on paper. We have to redefine what being a strong man is and heal. Love your mind.
My dad was a farmer. The guy was bigger than life. He wasn't someone that liked to show his emotion or liked to show when he was struggling, but we all struggle. I want to show emotion to my kids. It's something that brings me so much joy, and I want them to see me working through things. Allow your kids to know that it's okay to struggle, that even dad doesn't know the answer sometimes, but we're gonna figure it out together.
This is the Freeman Report on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right, so we're back. I'm just waiting for my guest to connect. I can see him, but I can't hear him at the moment, but he's just trying to connect. So before he joins us, I'm going to talk about what's going on in America at the moment. This is going to be my first question to Matt, is this bill that has just been passed. It's a cross-party bill. It's been supported by the Republicans and the Democrats. And basically, it's quite unusual, actually, because it's defining what anti-Semitism is. But the bill itself doesn't actually contain the definition. It basically subcontracts that to another organization, which is nothing to do with the government. Mats Nielsen, author and geopolitical expert, welcome to the Freeman Report. Mats, I'm not sure if you heard all of that, and if you did, what do you think about it?
Well, what's the thing? I mean, it's obvious now that we were making jokes beforehand that everything was anti-Semitism. And basically everything said was anti-Semitic. And now I think we've arrived at the point where everything is anti-Semitic. Netanyahu just recently, if it was yesterday, said that in case the ICC were to issue an arrest warrant or a warrant against anyone within the Israeli government, that was an act of anti-Semitism. And being a lawyer and legally schooled, you know that, I mean, law doesn't really look into what religion you have, at least not the ICC of today. There is nothing in the statutes that says people of the Jewish faith should be especially harshly looked upon. So obviously this is just more hot air from Netanyahu, who I think he's in a bind, because he really has nowhere to go. If he withdraws now, having killed up amongst 30,000 people in Gaza, the Israeli voters will tell him, why didn't you finish the job? So what scares me is that Netanyahu, who is actually contemplating finishing the job, because in Netanyahu's world, it doesn't really matter if he kills 30,000 or if he kills 60,000 and finishes the job. And by that, I mean partly cleansing Gaza, because the effects on Netanyahu's political career in the sense that he has one, will be more likely saved in Israel if he goes in and finishes the job and kills 60,000 people in Gaza. Why? Because the Western world won't apply sanctions on Israel anyhow. To the West, it doesn't matter if Israel kills 30,000 people or 60,000 people. We still won't apply any sanctions out of some kind of fear that Israel will tell us that we're anti-Semitic. So it's a multi-leveled propaganda war going on. And as always, Israel has always been quite good at the propaganda wars. But I think they've come to road's end this time. They're not going to get away with it anymore.
Are you surprised that this has received such cross-party support in America, this bill, given obviously, you know, the free speech is part of the Constitution in America. So there's that question. But also, I guess the other really interesting thing about this bill, and I can't remember the organization that defines it, but essentially the bill doesn't define anti-Semitism. It uses the definition of this external organization. So I guess on the first question, are you surprised this has just been pushed through in America?
Sadly, no, I'm not. I'm not surprised because there has always been the politicians in America feel that in order to get the vote and in order to not be sidelined by the media and by the Jewish communities or they need to do this. And of course, it's always a follow the money trail. The donors want them to do this. And as long as the donors want them to do it, I think they will do it. And also you have to remember that you have the religious crowd who is also getting behind Israel. So I'm not surprised.
And that was where I was thinking that the conversation would go on these donors. Now, you know, I've been talking quite a lot on this show recently about lobbies like AIPAC. There's lots of them in the US. Millions and millions and millions is flowing from these lobby companies into the hands of US politicians. Essentially, you know, the AIPAC, for example, I forget exactly what it was called, but Zionist was in the name. It's essentially a front for the Israeli government, I think a lot suspect. Now, the interesting thing is that these lobbies are given exemptions from a law which basically states that, you know, it puts restrictions on foreign lobby entities. But a lot of these lobbies have been given exemptions to this. And this is why we're seeing millions flowing into the hands of politicians. Do you think it's time that America faced up to this? Because it seems to me at the moment that all of this is potentially dragging the US into a full-blown Third World War.
Of course, we can wish it. And I mean, I think it's been, I seem to recall that the Congress members who were more supportive of Israel at the start of the war were the ones who have received $100,000 or $150,000 or more on average from pro-Israeli donors during the last election. Than those who came out in kind of support for Palestine. So it's campaign contribution from pro-Israel groups definitely has bearing on what stance the politician in Congress takes. So members who were more supportive to Israel received more from pro-Israel donors on average. And I mean, this has implications for American policy and what the American policies towards Israel looks like. We can joke about being able to buy politicians, but I think for many years now, especially with the new rules and laws concerning political donations, that you can make these donations to the PACs and so on, you can actually buy policy in American politics, and it's not a secret, and everyone knows it. And what the congressmen are doing are just applying laws so they can get around it and they can continue to do this. It's a self-feeding circle. The politicians decide that we need a new conflict. The conflict requires more weapons. More weapons are bought by taxpayer money. And the profits are returned to the politicians, who then go looking for another conflict that the military industry can pay them to ignite. So it's a self-feeding circle of death, more or less.
Yeah, and of course, there's big questions, isn't there, about whether all of this money from lobbyists should be flowing into government anyway. But I think on this issue, I think there is the question of, you know, there is this law in America that foreign entities can't. They put a lot of restrictions, but yeah, my thing is this doesn't apply. They've been given exemptions, so AIPAC and a lot of these other organizations. I do think it is something that Americans need to start looking at. Give me your assessment on the campuses, Matt, because I've had a few people on from the US in the past couple of weeks. They've really wound up the live chat because they've talked about, oh, all these dreadful lefties in the campuses, you know, they're breaking rules, they're disrupting things. And actually, that's the reason that the police have been sent in. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's quite encouraging. That's what students are supposed to do. They're supposed to protest, and protests. I mean, it's a part of the youthful culture, and I think we all remember what happened back in the 60s and the Kent State Universities and all the student protests against Vietnam. So it's. For me, it's quite natural for the protests to have commenced and for them to be ongoing. The only thing I was hoping for is that they would be more widespread within other segments of the American public or the American civil society, perhaps within certain churches and the Quakers and people like this actually protesting in different areas. But we have to be happy that there is actually some opposition to the current policy in America. And I mean, be they leftist or be they rightist, I myself am not particularly leftist as such, but there is a breach in the order of things, the way Israel is defending itself. They have gone above and beyond what is necessary for any civilized society. So I don't see it particularly as a leftist, rightist protest. There could be conservatives protesting Israel on the grounds that Israel is going too far in its issue of self-defense from a strictly legal standpoint. It's obvious that war crimes are committed, and one could argue that perhaps it's a genocide. The ruling will tell, but definitely war crimes are committed. And I don't think you have to be particularly leftist or rightist to protest ongoing war crimes, no matter where they are.
Now, this is a huge question that we could spend, I'm sure, several shows discussing the two-state solution. Do you think it's dead? Do you think it's at all feasible that can move forward now?
This is, yeah, exactly. We could spend many shows on this. I think that I've always advocated that the best thing to do or the West is to actually withdraw all its aid to Palestine and leave Palestine for Israel, because Palestine is basically kept on resuscitation by Western aid. And Israel survives the occupation. Israel would have had to pay immense amounts of money to be able to integrate Palestine if the West would have withdrawn. And I don't think Israel would have wanted that. So what the West needs to do is put pressure on Israel and say, you want to pay for this occupation, you want to keep the occupation, then you need to pay for it yourself. And then you might be able to get Israel to the negotiating table for a serious discussion about a two-state solution within the areas that are still available. Because Israel has already gone well beyond its specified borders. So it's difficult to say what kind of Palestinian state would still be left to negotiate.
Yeah, and
about.
that's the point, yeah. Isn't it? I think on land that the UN says is Palestine's after the 1967 war, a lot of that now, I think there's 800,000 Israeli settlers on that land now. So I mean, it's just unthinkable that you could move that many people, that it's actually feasible to move that many people. And I guess the big question is, look, even if Israel came and said, yeah, OK, well, you can have what you've got left now, I think there's a lot of Palestinians who just will not accept that because, you know, Palestine, Gaza have got smaller and smaller. There's some you will have seen the maps online on social media, you know, showing it over the decades, getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Wonder whether it's even possible, even if it was on the table, for that to happen.
I don't think so, because it's like you say, Israel has engulfed so much of beyond its specified borders, that it would be very difficult for any Palestinian government to accept it. Because on the 14th of May 1948, the State of Israel was declared on the basis of the partition plan borders specified in that plan. And it was recognized as a state within those boundaries by both the United States and then the Soviet Union. But Israel tries to blur this distinction and say, oh, this is, we're discussing the 1967 borders and so on and so forth. But from a legal standpoint, it's the partition plan borders that Israel themselves stated that was their borders that should be discussed. And if you're going to take that negotiation, it's going to be a long negotiations. And for them to succeed, America needs to apply pressure towards Israel, which you and I both know isn't likely to happen.
Yeah, and I wonder if actually those Israelis living or Jewish people living on that Palestinian land, whether they should give that land back to Palestine, and then they will be living in another country's land, and then they can see fit to whatever they do. Anyway, Mats, we have run out of time, but listen, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Back onto the Freeman Report. Please do come back again soon.
Thank you very much.
Right, that's it for me today. I'll be back tomorrow. It's Friday, the end of the week. I've got a fantastic show lined up for you tomorrow, so don't miss that. And don't go anywhere now either, because we've got more great shows coming up right here on TNT.